Imagine waking up tomorrow morning and discovering that a corporation just legally erased 30% of your life savings overnight.
Right, just gone.
Just gone, yeah. And not just that, they also increased your risk of heart disease by like up to 80%. And they actively stunted your child's ability to learn how to read.
It sounds like the plot of a thriller, honestly.
It really does. But all of this was accomplished without bulldozing a single house or, you know, tearing up the single street. It happened simply by drawing an invisible line in the sky directly above your roof. Welcome to the Deep Dive, everyone. It is Tuesday, April 14th, 2026, and today we're looking at what happens when the acoustic landscape of an entire region is permanently altered.
Yeah, and it really is a profound shock to the human system, right? Both biologically and economically, because we're examining a situation where the fundamental rhythm of a community's daily life has been completely rewritten from above.
Exactly. So our mission today is to explore this massive, highly detailed stack of sources provided by a grassroots citizen group in the Tri-Cities area of British Columbia.
Right. And for those unfamiliar with the geography of Canada's West Coast, we're talking about the municipalities of Coquitlam, Port Moody, Port Coquitlam, New Westminster, and North Burnaby. So these are dense, highly populated suburban areas just outside of Vancouver.
Right. And to ground you in the timeline, late last year, so we're talking late 2025, NAV Canada, which is the private corporation that owns and operates Canada's civil aviation navigation system, they implemented a series of new flight paths.
Yeah, these new routes basically diverted hundreds of daily commercial flights directly over these Tri-Cities neighborhoods.
And the materials we're reviewing today, they represent the organized response from the people actually living in those neighborhoods. It's a campaign built by residents who are actively trying to reverse these flight path changes.
And they're using a really highly sophisticated compilation of medical, economic, and statistical data to make their case.
They really are. Now, before we dive into that data, I need to lay down some strict ground rules for you, the listener. The materials we've been given to review are, well, they're highly charged.
Very much so.
Yeah. They're advocacy-driven perspectives, right?
Yeah.
Aim squarely at government officials and NAV Canada with the explicit goal of forcing a route reversal.
And our role today is not to take a side.
Right.
We are not endorsing the viewpoints of this citizen group, nor are we, you know, acting as a defense for NAV Canada. Our job is strictly analytical. We're going to impartially dissect the evidence this grassroots group has presented.
Exactly. We're examining the specific public health studies, the real estate market data, the acoustic physics.
All the stuff they're using to build their argument.
Right. Putting their framework under the microscope to understand exactly how this invisible infrastructure change impacts human beings on the ground.
Okay, let's unpack this. I want to start by looking at the sheer raw numbers of the situation. Because when we talk about airplanes flying overhead, the mental image that usually conjures up is, I don't know, a jet coasting by every now and then while you're gardening.
Right. It sounds relatively benign. Yeah. But the reality outlined in these sources paints a picture of intense, unrelenting industrial volume.
Let's look at the frequency metrics they've pulled.
The frequency is really the engine driving this entire dispute.
Yeah, yeah.
If you don't grasp the sheer volume of air traffic involved, all the ensuing medical and economic data, it'll just seem disproportionate.
Okay, so let's get into it.
So the grassroots group anchors their argument in the official statistics from the Vancouver International Airport YVR for the year 2025.
Let's break down that math. YVR handled 297,350 aircraft movements in 2025.
That's a lot of planes.
It is a staggering number. Now, an aircraft movement is classified as either a takeoff or a landing. Because the Tri-Cities region is situated directly on the new arrivals path, the group focuses entirely on the landings.
Right, which cuts the number exactly in half.
Exactly, leaving us with 148,675 landings flying over this specific corridor in a single year. Which is, you know, an incredibly abstract number. Human brains just aren't well equipped to visualize what 148,000 of anything looks or feels like, let alone giant jetliners.
Right. It's too big to comprehend.
Exactly. To comprehend the environmental impact, you have to distill that annual figure down into the rhythm of a single day.
Okay, so divide 148,675 by 365 days, and you get 407 landings every single day. Divide that by 24 hours, and you're looking at roughly 17 landings an hour.
17 an hour.
Yeah. On average, over a 24-hour period, that means a commercial airplane is flying over these homes every 3.5 minutes.
But, and this is crucial, we have to be very careful with the word average here.
Why is that?
Because aviation traffic does not operate on a perfectly even spread across a 24-hour clock. You know, there are mandatory quiet periods in the dead of night. There are lulls in the early morning.
Right, of course.
This means the daytime and evening hours, the times when people are awake, working, relaxing, basically trying to live their lives, those hours bear a massively disproportionate load of that traffic.
So it's concentrated.
Highly concentrated. The group's data points out that during peak hours, this schedule accelerates dramatically. Residents are experiencing an airplane flying overhead every 2 minutes, or in some windows, even less.
Okay, I was trying to wrap my head around what a 2-minute interval actually feels like in practice. Because if a plane flies over once an hour, it's a drip you can ignore, right? It's like a dripping faucet in the other room. You might notice it, but it doesn't stop you from reading a book or having a conversation.
Exactly.
But every 2 minutes during peak hours, that changes the fundamental acoustic landscape of a neighborhood. It becomes the dominant feature of your day. It's not a drip anymore, it's a fire hose.
Yeah, from a purely psychological and neurological perspective, that shift from a 60-minute interval to a 2-minute interval is catastrophic for human attention.
Catastrophic.
Truly. When a loud noise event happens once an hour, your brain has plenty of time to process the interruption, dismiss it, and return to a baseline state of relaxation. The nervous system resets.
Okay, that makes sense.
But when the interval shrinks to 120 seconds, your brain never achieves that reset. You enter a state of chronic anticipation. Even during that brief window of quiet between the planes, your subconscious is actively bracing for the next roar.
You're basically living inside an active transportation corridor at that point, rather than a residential suburb. I mean, think about the logistics of a simple weekend afternoon. You can't have a normal conversation in your backyard.
They'd be shouting.
Yeah. You can't watch a movie with the windows open without reaching for the remote to pause it constantly. But wait, let me play devil's advocate for a second.
Sure.
Airports have been around for nearly a century. People have lived near flight paths for decades. Is a plane passing overhead really loud enough to completely stop a conversation? Or is this group perhaps exaggerating the intrusiveness of the sound?
That is the exact question that forms the crux of the dispute between the citizens and the regulatory bodies. And it brings us to a major point of contention in the source material, which is how sound is actually measured, visualized, and reported to the public. The citizens group points out a massive structural disconnect between the official noise maps drawn by NAV Canada and the acoustic reality experienced on the ground.
Right, the sources refer to this as the decibel disconnect. And this is where the group transitions from, qualitative complaints about annoyance into a hard empirical case against the official maps.
Yeah, they point directly to NAV Canada's official noise footprints.
And these are the diagrams generated to show the public and the government the geographic areas heavily affected by the new ROTS, right?
Exactly. But what's fascinating here is how they define heavily affected. According to the source documents, NAV Canada's diagrams only draw noise contours for areas experiencing sound above 55 decibels.
55 decibels.
Right. The maps literally draw a line at the 55 decibel mark. If your neighborhood sits outside that specific geographic contour officially, you are not considered to be in a heavily impacted noise zone. Your area just appears completely blank on the map.
Which, I mean, sounds perfectly reasonable on the surface. You have to draw the line somewhere.
You do. But the citizens group contrasts that official 55 decibel threshold with the World Health Organization's environmental noise guidelines, which were updated in 2018.
Oh, okay. What does the WHO say?
The WHO sets 45 decibels as the strict maximum acceptable nighttime noise level, and they explicitly state that above 45 decibels, there are documented severe health risks.
Wait, so we have a 10 decibel gap between what the World Health Organization considers a medical hazard and what NAV Canada is even bothering to draw on their official maps.
Precisely. Now, I know it sounds like a minor bureaucratic discrepancy, just 10 units of measurement, right?
Right. It doesn't sound like a huge difference.
Because we intuitively think of decibels like degrees on a thermometer.
Yeah.
If the temperature goes from 70 degrees to 75 degrees, it's just a little bit warmer. It's a linear progression.
Sure.
But the decibel scale is logarithmic.
Okay, let's make sure we clearly define what that logarithmic scale actually means in practice, because this completely changes how you read the data.
Yeah, it's similar to the Richter scale used for earthquakes. A magnitude 6 earthquake isn't just one step worse than a magnitude 5, it is 10 times larger in amplitude.
Wow. Okay.
With sound, the logarithmic scale means that a 5 decibel increase is not a small incremental bump. According to the physics of acoustics cited in these guidelines, a 5 decibel increase represents a literal doubling of perceived noise to the human ear.
Wait, let me stop you there because the math on that is wild.
It is.
If just 5 decibels makes a sound twice as loud, that means the 10 decibel gap between the WHO's safety limit of 45 and NEF Canada's reporting threshold of 55 isn't just a minor oversight.
Yeah.
It means 55 decibels is roughly 4 times as loud as the maximum safe limit recommended by the Global Health Authority.
Yes.
Are the official maps entirely leaving out communities that are experiencing noise levels quadruple the WHO safety threshold?
Based on the data provided by the Citizens Group, yes, absolutely. By arbitrarily setting the visual reporting threshold at 55 decibels, the official diagrams are effectively rendering a massive portion of the affected population completely invisible to regulators.
That's incredible.
The official map looks clean, right? It's confined to a small, tight footprint around the immediate airport vicinity. Meanwhile, the actual lived reality, where the noise is doubling, quadrupling over scientifically established safe limits, that reality sprawls miles further out across the entirety of the Tri-Cities.
It functions as a visualization trick. If you don't start drawing the contour lines until 55, you never have to formally acknowledge the tens of thousands of people suffering at 50 decibels, even though 50 is twice as loud as the WHO limit.
Exactly. It keeps the problem off the books, so to speak.
But I want to push back on this a bit.
Okay, go ahead.
A quiet library is roughly 40 decibels. A normal refrigerator humming is about 40 to 45 decibels. Normal conversation is around 60. Are we really supposed to believe that hitting 50 or 55 decibels of intermittent aircraft noise is suddenly a public health crisis?
That is a very common counterargument, and it is entirely based on a misunderstanding of how environmental noise interacts with human biology over prolonged periods.
How so?
The gap between 45 and 55 decibels isn't just the difference between sleeping soundly and being slightly annoyed. According to the medical literature presented by the group, that 45 to 55 window is the exact threshold where physical, irreversible damage begins to accumulate in the human body.
So if a conversation is 60 decibels, why isn't talking to my friend a health hazard, but an airplane overhead at 60 decibels is?
It comes down to frequency, duration, and the biological perception of the sound's origin.
Okay, break that down for me.
A conversation is a voluntary, dynamically changing acoustic exchange that you're actively participating in. Aircraft noise, on the other hand, is an involuntary, low-frequency, high-energy intrusion. It physically penetrates walls and windows, and the body processes these two sounds entirely differently.
I see.
This is exactly where the source material pivots from discussing noise as a mere nuisance to presenting it as an active medical hazard.
And the studies they've compiled to back this up are incredibly heavy. We're moving into what we could call the silent toll of the sky.
Yes, the cardiovascular data is really sobering.
They dive deeply into cardiovascular health, leaning on some very robust long-term epidemiological research. The standout piece of evidence here is the Greiser et al. Study, published in the Journal of Public Health in 2007.
The scale of the Greiser study is what makes it so difficult to dismiss. You know, they didn't just poll a few hundred people who felt annoyed. They analyzed the medical records of over 1 million insured residents living near Germany's Cologne-Bonn airport.
1 million people.
1 million. And they cross-referenced precise geographic noise exposure data with actual medical outcomes over time.
What were the specific findings when they looked at 1 million people living under a flight path?
Well, they isolated populations exposed to daytime aircraft noise at 60 decibels. And keep in mind, the Tri-Cities group explicitly states that their neighborhoods now regularly exceed this 60 decibel threshold multiple times an hour.
Right.
The German study found that chronic exposure to that specific level of aircraft noise increased the incidence of coronary heart disease by 61% in men and a staggering 80% in women.
Wait. 61% and 80%?
Yes.
Those aren't marginal, debatable statistical bugs. If a new food additive or, I don't know, a common prescription drug was found to cause an 80% increase in coronary heart disease, it would be recalled globally by the end of the week.
Absolutely. And to ensure this wasn't an isolated anomaly from just one German airport, the grassroots group broadens the scope. They integrate data from the European Environment Agency's comprehensive 2020 report.
What did their report find?
The EEA data estimates that environmental noise with aircraft noise explicitly named as a major primary contributor causes roughly 12,000 premature deaths and 48,000 new cases of ischemic heart disease every single year across Europe.
12,000 premature deaths a year. directly attributed to environmental noise.
It's terrifying.
This is the hardest part of the data to digest. How does an invisible vibration in the air translate into a blocked artery in the human heart? What is the actual biological mechanism connecting sound waves to cardiovascular failure? Because on the surface, honestly, it sounds like pseudoscience.
It does sound unbelievable until you look at evolutionary biology. We have to stop thinking of noise as merely an auditory experience processed by our ears. It is a profound, whole-body physical stressor.
Okay, unpack that.
Throughout the millions of years of human evolution, a sudden, loud, low-frequency rumble almost always signaled imminent mortal danger.
Like an approaching rock slide.
Exactly. A rock slide, a stampeding herd, a predator, or a severe storm.
Right. Our bodies are hardwired to react to that specific acoustic profile as a threat to our survival.
Precisely. The UK National Air Traffic Services data cited in these sources puts typical maximum aircraft noise levels, the LMAX, at 65 to 74 decibels as they pass over residential homes.
Okay.
When a human body hears that rumble, the brain's amygdala, you know, the ancient emotional processing center, instantly interprets it as a threat.
Even if you consciously, logically know that it's just a commercial 737 flying a routine route to Toronto.
Exactly. Your conscious cerebral cortex knows you're safe in your living room, but your autonomic nervous system does not care. It operates entirely below the level of conscious thought.
So it's an automatic reflex.
Yes. The instant that low-frequency roar hits your auditory nerve, the amygdala fires, triggering a sympathetic nervous system stress response. It immediately dumps a cascade of cortisol and adrenaline into your bloodstream. Your blood pressure spikes, your heart rate elevates, your breathing becomes shallower, and your blood vessels physically constrict. It's pushing blood to your major muscle groups to prepare you to either fight for your life or run away.
Here's where it gets really interesting. You have this massive evolutionary chemical dump preparing you for combat, but you're just sitting on your couch reading a book.
Right.
And the plane passes, the noise fades. What happens to all those stress hormones?
They slowly dissipate. But remember the frequency data from the first section of the report. Imagine that exact fight or flight chemical cascade triggering in your cardiovascular system every 2 minutes during peak hours. Day after day, month after month.
Oh, man. The biological system just breaks down from overuse.
Yes. The constant flooding of cortisol and adrenaline leads to chronic hypertension, high blood pressure. Over time, that constant high pressure physically damages and scars the endothelial lining, which is the delicate inner wall of your blood vessels.
And that scarring is bad news.
Very bad. That scarring creates sites where plaque accumulates, which directly manifests as coronary heart disease, strokes, and, as the European data grimly confirms, premature death.
We culturally treat noise pollution as a lifestyle annoyance.
Mm.
You know, people complain about their neighbor's leaf blower or a loud motorcycle because it's irritating.
Mm.
But the epidemiological data this group has compiled paints airplane noise as an invisible public health crisis.
It really is.
It is biologically akin to breathing in smog. If a factory was built next to your house and started pumping invisible toxic chemical smog into your bedroom every 2 minutes, causing an 80% spike in heart disease, you'd evacuate.
The government would shut the factory down immediately.
Exactly. Yet this acoustic smog is doing measurable physical permanent damage to residents' cardiovascular systems, and it is completely legal under the current NAV Canada flight path regulations.
Acoustic smog is a highly effective way to conceptualize it. It perfectly captures the pervasive, inescapable nature of the problem. You can close your eyes to block out bright lights, but you cannot close your ears. The acoustic smog penetrates the walls of the home.
You can't turn it off.
And if we follow the logic of this biological stress response, the adults dealing with hypertension and heart disease aren't even the most vulnerable demographic being impacted in these communities.
No, because if an adult's autonomic nervous system is firing off fight or flight cortisol every 2 minutes, causing long-term vascular damage, what happens to a 6-year-old child's brain under that same acoustic assault?
It's devastating.
Children don't have fully developed neurological systems to process and filter out environmental stressors. Which brings us directly to the next major pillar of the community's argument, the impact on local schools.
The organizers are incredibly focused on the classroom crisis. They explicitly map out that there are multiple elementary and secondary schools located directly under the footprint of these newly implemented routes in the Tri-Cities.
That's terrifying for a parent.
Right. And to demonstrate the developmental risk to the children sitting in those classrooms, they cite the RNCH study.
For the listener, that's RANCH. This study was published in the Lancet Medical Journal back in 2005. And it's important to note that the Lancet is widely considered one of the oldest and most prestigious peer-reviewed medical journals in the world.
Absolutely. This is not fringe science.
How did the RNCH study measure the impact of noise on children?
Well, the RNCH study was a massive cross-national epidemiological study specifically designed to examine the cognitive and health effects of aircraft noise on children at schools located under flight paths.
Okay, so a direct comparison.
Yeah, they compared these students to peer control groups in demographically similar but quiet environments. The findings regarding reading comprehension are incredibly sobering.
What did they find?
They found that children in these noise-impacted environments lose up to 2 months of reading progress per year compared to their peers in quiet schools.
Wait, 2 months of reading progress lost every single academic year?
Every single year. Now, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the compounding effect of that deficit is staggering. If a student loses 2 months of reading progress in first grade, a parent might think, well, that's recoverable with some summer tutoring.
Sure. Sounds fixable.
But children don't just attend a school for 1 year. If that child attends the same elementary school from kindergarten through fifth grade, sitting under that exact same flight path for six consecutive years, that deficit compounds mathematically.
Oh, wow.
They are losing over a full year of critical literacy development before they even reach middle school.
It creates a permanent developmental handicap that alters the entire trajectory of their education. But let's get into the weeds on how this actually happens in a real-world classroom.
Okay.
If kids are losing 2 months of reading progress, what's functionally occurring in that room? Are they just looking out the window and getting distracted by the planes? Or is there a biological reason their brains aren't retaining the words on the page?
The research indicates it is a dual failure: acoustic masking and cognitive exhaustion.
Acoustic masking?
First, there's the raw physical reality of acoustic masking. The low-frequency rumble of a commercial jet literally overpowers the specific auditory frequencies of human speech.
So they just can't hear the teacher.
Right. This means the child physically cannot hear the consonant sounds of the teacher's instructions or the phonetics of the words they're trying to sound out aloud. The teacher is forced to stop talking, wait for the noise event to pass, and then try to regain the lost momentum of the lesson.
And if you're forced to pause a lesson plan 17 times an hour, the lesson plan ceases to exist.
Yeah.
It's just a series of disconnected fragments.
Exactly. But the second, much more insidious factor is the cognitive load. Literacy acquisition, the act of turning abstract symbols on a piece of paper into meaningful concepts in the mind that requires deep, sustained, unbroken focus.
It's hard work for a little kid.
It is incredibly taxing on a child's working memory. When a child's attention is fragmented by a fight-or-flight acoustic intrusion every 2 minutes, their brain has to expend a massive amount of metabolic energy just to calm down and refocus on the task at hand.
The constant interruption completely shatters the critical periods of deep cognitive processing required for reading. They aren't just missing hearing a few words. Their fundamental capacity to concentrate is being actively eroded by the environment. It's cognitive exhaustion.
Yes. They are spending all their mental energy filtering out the environment, leaving nothing left for comprehension.
That's heartbreaking.
You have parents who likely spent months researching school districts, paying a premium to buy a home in a specific neighborhood because it had excellent schools, only to have the airspace above that school transformed into an acoustic hazard zone that actively prevents their children from learning to read.
Which logically forces us to look at the macroeconomic reality of this situation. When a neighborhood becomes scientifically hazardous to cardiovascular health and demonstrably hostile to a child's educational development, the free market is going to react.
Oh, absolutely.
Desirability plummets, and the housing market reacts violently to environmental degradation.
This is where the abstract decibel numbers and the long-term medical warnings translate into immediate, devastating financial realities.
Right.
The grassroots group dedicates a massive portion of their platform to the economic destruction caused by these new flight paths. They point to a very recent, highly comprehensive study, a 2025 working paper from MIT and the National Bureau of Economic Research titled "Planes Overhead: How Airplane Noise Impacts Home Values."
Okay, how exactly did the MIT researchers quantify the financial impact? Did they just look at homes near airports versus homes far away?
It was much more sophisticated than that. They analyzed millions of real estate transactions over time, isolating the specific variable of aircraft noise while controlling for other neighborhood factors.
And what did they find?
The MIT and NBER study concluded that a 1 decibel increase in the annual day-night average aircraft noise reduces house prices by 0.6 to 1%.
Okay, let's apply that formula to the specific reality in the Tri-Cities. A 0.6 to 1% loss in overall property value for every single decibel increase. The grassroots group explicitly states that their local neighborhoods are experiencing a 20 to 30 decibel increase over their previous baseline before the late 2025 route changes.
The math here is terrifying for any homeowner.
Let's do it.
If you take the absolute most conservative end of the MIT study's findings, a 0.6% drop per decibel, and apply it to a 20 decibel increase, you're looking at a 12% immediate drop in the total value of the home.
And if you take the high end of both metrics, a 1% drop per decibel on a 30 decibel increase, you're looking at a catastrophic 30% destruction of property value.
For the vast majority of citizens, their home is not just a place to live, it is their primary and often only significant financial asset. It's their retirement plan, their collateral for loans, their nest egg to pass on to their children. A 12 to 30% loss on a home in the Vancouver metropolitan area represents hundreds of thousands of dollars evaporating into thin air, completely outside of the homeowner's control.
Let's talk about the invisible market mechanisms of how that equity actually evaporates.
Mm-hmm.
Because the house didn't physically change, the foundation is still solid, the roof is still good. How does an invisible sound wave cause a buyer to drop their offer by $100,000?
It comes down to the psychology of the real estate transaction and the concept of environmental stigma.
Environmental stigma. Okay.
Imagine a young couple attending a Saturday afternoon open house in one of these Coquitlam or Port Moody neighborhoods. They love the kitchen. They love the yard. They're standing on the patio discussing putting in an offer. Suddenly, a commercial jet flies over at 65 decibels, entirely drowning out their conversation.
Right.
2 minutes later, as they are walking to their car, it happens again.
The illusion of the suburban sanctuary is instantly shattered.
Exactly. The buyer immediately perceives the environment as compromised. They either walk away entirely, increasing the time on market for the seller, or they factor the noise into their bid, offering significantly less to compensate for the reduced quality of life.
And then what happens?
As these lower bids are accepted out of desperation, they become the new comparable sales for the neighborhood. And the entire algorithmic valuation of the area spirals downward.
The group also includes a really fascinating counterexample to prove this point about the strict inverse relationship between aircraft noise and property values. They cite a 2020 study by Zeng et al.
Okay.
In the journal Land Use Policy, which looked at the historical data from Hong Kong's old Kai Tak Airport.
Kai Tak is legendary and somewhat infamous in global aviation history. It was notoriously located right in the middle of incredibly dense residential neighborhoods.
Oh, right. The crazy approach videos on YouTube.
Yes. To land at Kai Tak, commercial planes had to perform a massive low-altitude, high-banking turn right over high-rise apartment buildings. The sensory experience of living under that approach was absolutely deafening.
But Kai Tak was eventually closed. And operations were relocated to a new facility much further away. What did the Zeng study find when they analyzed the real estate data after the airport closed?
They found that when the aircraft noise was finally removed from that specific urban corridor, nearby property values didn't just stabilize, they surged. Specifically, values increased by 24.43% once the noise pollution was eliminated.
Wow. The market instantly recognized the massive increase in the quality of life, the reduction in acoustic smog, and priced the real estate accordingly.
The Tri-Cities grassroots group is arguing that the exact reverse of the Kai Tak miracle is happening to them right now. By dumping a massive volume of commercial noise onto their previously quiet neighborhoods, NAV Canada is forcibly extracting that quality of life. And the free market is severely penalizing the homeowners for a corporate infrastructure decision they had no say in.
So what does this all mean? When you pull back from the individual studies and look at the whole picture this grassroots group has painted, it shifts the narrative completely.
It really does.
This is not a story about wealthy suburbanites complaining because they want a quiet backyard barbecue on a Sunday afternoon. We're talking about highly documented cardiovascular risks. We're talking about the measurable stunting of children's educational development. And we're talking about a private corporation's route change effectively wiping out up to a third of these residents' life savings overnight with absolutely zero compensation or mitigation offered.
And when a community is faced with dire health risks, failing schools, and plummeting life savings, the natural and perhaps only rational response is organized resistance.
Which brings us to the final section of the sources we are reviewing today. the current battle on the ground, and the mechanics of modern civic pushback.
The grassroots rebellion.
Right, the grassroots rebellion. The citizens of Coquitlam, Port Moody, Port Coquitlam, New Westminster, and North Burnaby are not just compiling medical journals and real estate data to complain into the void. They have constructed a very specific, actionable plan to force a total reversal of these routes.
If you look closely at the "Who We Are" section of their campaign materials, the framing is particularly telling. They explicitly state they are parents, homeowners, and local residents.
Regular people.
Exactly. They proudly declare they accept absolutely zero corporate or special interest funding. This is entirely organic and grassroots. And their core demand is singular and uncompromising. They are demanding that their elected officials at every level of government, municipal mayors, provincial representatives, and federal members of parliament step in and protect them from what they explicitly label as a private corporation's cost-cutting decision.
They're framing this not just as an annoyance, but as a fundamental failure of government oversight. Their argument is that the government allowed a private entity to externalize its operational costs directly onto the health and wealth of the citizens.
Precisely.
So what is their actual strategy to fix it? How do everyday people force a National Aviation Authority to change its mind? Because they've laid out a very clear, multi-tiered call to action on their platform.
They clearly understand that generating political pressure requires creating friction for politicians. But to get the public to act, you have to make participating as frictionless as possible.
That's a great point. How are they doing that?
First, they are driving people to sign a central petition, noting that thousands of residents already have. A massive, localized petition proves to politicians that there is a highly mobilized, angry voting bloc that cares deeply about this single issue, which naturally threatens their reelection.
Right. And second, and I think this is the most brilliant part of their tactical approach, they aren't just asking people to write letters to their representatives. They know that asking an exhausted parent to sit down and stare at a blank email is a massive barrier to entry.
Nobody has the energy for that.
No. So they have a pre-written template available right on the site. They're telling residents, copy this text, personalize it with your home address, and hit send to your specific elected officials. It takes 2 minutes. They're effectively automating the outrage.
And third, they are focusing heavily on hyper-local education. Their call to action includes a mandate to tell neighbors who might not realize why their neighborhood suddenly got so loud.
Because people might just not know.
Right. They know that human beings are adaptable. Many people might just think, wow, the airport is really busy today, or the wind must be blowing a weird direction, without realizing a prominent structural change has occurred in the invisible infrastructure above them. Spreading the website and the hard data is key to building their numbers and preventing the community from just passively accepting the new normal.
Now, you look at this setup, and it's a classic David versus Goliath scenario. You have individual residents armed with medical journals and property data trying to run a volunteer political campaign in their spare time between their day jobs and raising kids.
It's a huge undertaking.
And they're going head-to-head against NAV Canada, a massive, entrenched national aviation authority that controls the airspace of the second largest country on Earth. It feels entirely insurmountable. Have communities ever actually won a fight like this?
It does feel like an impossible uphill battle, but the group highlights a critical piece of historical precedent to offer hope and momentum to their supporters. They state very clearly in their materials. Communities across North America have successfully reversed flight path changes.
That is a massive point. These flight paths are not unchangeable laws of physics. They aren't rivers or mountains.
Exactly. This is the crucial takeaway from a regulatory standpoint. These flight paths are not permanent, unalterable decrees. They are simply administrative decisions made on a computer screen. And administrative decisions can be unmade, provided the political cost of maintaining the routes becomes higher than the logistical cost of reversing them.
But I have to play devil's advocate here.
Go for it.
Given that these flight paths already went live in late 2025, how much harder is it to roll back a massive logistical system that is currently in motion versus stopping one before it starts? The planes are already in the sky. The major airlines have already optimized their fuel loads, their crew schedules, and their arrival slots for these specific new routes. The inertia must be incredible.
You are entirely correct that inertia is the most powerful force in large bureaucracies. It is undeniably more difficult to reverse a system that has already been implemented than to block one in the planning stages.
So it's a steeper hill to climb.
It is. However, while the planes are indeed already flying, the sheer weight of the combined data this group has assembled provides an incredibly robust, multi-angled foundation for their political pressure campaign.
It's not a single-issue complaint that a politician can easily brush off.
Right. If the grassroots group only complained about the annoyance of the noise, they could easily be dismissed by officials as nimby-wise, not in my backyard.
Right, stop whining about the noise kind of thing.
Exactly. But by layering the WHO logarithmic decibel data, the 61 to 80% heart disease risk increase from the Cologne study, the RNCH study showing 2 months of lost reading progress in children, and the MIT data showing a potential 30% drop in property values, they have created a holistic, impenetrable argument.
It's bulletproof.
They're attacking the issue from a public health angle, a child development angle, and a macroeconomic angle simultaneously. It makes it politically toxic for an elected official to simply ignore them, because doing so makes the politician look entirely callous to the physical health, the educational future, and the financial survival of their own constituents.
It's a fascinating look at modern civic action. And honestly, looking at the staggering scope of the issue they've laid out, it is incredibly easy to see why they are fighting so relentlessly.
Absolutely.
To recap what we've unpacked today for you, the listener, what starts as the seemingly minor annoyance of a commercial airplane flying overhead every 2 minutes quickly scales into a terrifying biological and economic reality.
A reality that's hard to ignore once you see the numbers.
We're talking about 61% higher heart disease risk for men and 80% for women due to chronic cortisol spikes. We're looking at 2 months of lost reading progress every single year for young kids sitting in classrooms under these paths. And we're looking at up to a 30% destruction of property values, life savings, completely erased by environmental stigma.
And all of this is carefully hidden behind official 55 decibel maps that fail to reflect the true, compounding, exponential damage of the noise.
The citizens of the Tri-Cities have organized, they have mastered the data, and they are demanding that their elected officials step in to reverse what they view as a catastrophic corporate overreach.
The evidence they presented is robust, heavily cited, and deeply concerning for anyone living near an airport. The only question now is whether the political will exists to force a massive aviation authority to change course.
It is a battle we will certainly keep a close eye on as it develops in the coming months. But before we wrap up today's deep dive, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over. Something that wasn't explicitly written in the sources, but that this entire situation brings to light.
What's that?
Think about the airspace above your own home right now. When you walk outside and look up, we tend to view the sky as this infinite empty void. It's just air. It's nothing.
Right.
But today's deep dive shows us that airspace is actually a highly valuable, highly contested piece of invisible real estate. When a flight route changes, someone somewhere down on the ground is paying the ultimate price for that logistical convenience in their health and their wealth. So it begs a much larger, much more unsettling question. Who really owns the quiet above your roof?
It's a vital question for the modern age as our skies become increasingly crowded.
It really is. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We appreciate you taking the time to explore this complex and deeply impactful issue with us. We will see you next time.